Coyote walked out to meet Tiburon. Tiburon then reached behind him, pulled out the gun, and began shooting. Other dudes with him opened fire as well. The Sangre guy scattered. One of them walked off for a few steps, fell, got up, and then fell again. He died there on the sidewalk. In the wee hours of the morning, plainclothes detectives busted into several homes belonging to Loma's members. They were being arrested for the murder of 16-year-old David Alcon. One of those they picked up was Chicharron. The police issued a warrant for Tiburon's arrest. He was nowhere to be found. For weeks, the police combed the hills, visited his family, even called on authorities in Mexico. Then, in the hills, in the quiet of night, somebody thrust a shotgun through a bedroom window and opened fire, striking Tiburon's 13-year-old brother in the head. Pellet holes and blood scattered on the far wall. Sangre claimed the shooting. Soon after, Tiburon turned himself in. A jury found Tiburon guilty of murder, and he was sent up to San Quentin. Chicharron, who was 17 then, was found guilty of accessory to murder and sentenced to YTS prison in Chino. A couple other dudes from the hills received various lesser charges relating to Alcon's death. Junior no longer came to play in the backyard. Sochi took care of him following Chicharron's verdict. Chicharron then left to serve his time. I was the last of anyone who ever claimed Los Cuatro. I started to see more of Camila. She moved in with an older sister after being thrown out from her mother's house. But once her mother found out I was seeing her, she started to spend more time at the house on Ferris Avenue where Camila and her sister Irma lived. The first time I took Camila to a movie, her mother forced Camila's younger brother to come along, armed with a kitchen knife in case I got out of hand. Once, I drove a large bobtail truck to the front of Garfield High School to pick up Camila after school. As I strolled the walkway leading up on the main building, dudes moved out of the way, some giving me nods as Camila waited for me, smiling on the school's steps. She looked so pretty, with skin of soft brown, shapely legs, and a shapely behind, and one of the cutest faces I'd ever seen. I felt proud to be her boyfriend. Everything seemed to come my way with a beautiful woman at my side. The woman screamed, but nobody appeared to hear. I saw a couple of deputies push her against a car parked in the lot of an after-hours club in Norwalk. I looked to see if anybody else was around, but the few who were there turned away, ignoring the screams as a deputy punched the woman in the face. "Hey, get off her," I yelled. I didn't know who she was or what she did. I just couldn't stand there and witness the beating. "Get the fuck out of here now," shouted an officer as he pulled hard on the woman's arm so he could put handcuffs on her. Her face smashed against the asphalt, bleeding from the mouth. "Pinche cabrones," he managed to say. "Leave her alone. Can't you see you're hurting her?" At this, a couple of deputies pounced on me. I fell to the ground. Officers pulled on my arms, picked me up, and threw me against a squad car. I felt the blows of a blackjack against my side and back. I tried to pull them off me, when suddenly eight other deputies showed up. As they pounded on me, my foot inadvertently came up and brushed one of them in the chest. The deputies threw me inside a squad car, the woman in another. By then, a crowd had gathered, but they appeared helpless as more deputies swarmed the club's parking lot. For about a half hour, the squad car drove around. A deputy hit me in the stomach. Another struck me in the face. You got something to say? It looks like you got something to say to us, an officer implored. I didn't say anything, not even fuck you. I felt my cheek swell. Another fist smashed into an eye, the end of a blackjack into a rib. I clenched my teeth, holding back a cry so that they couldn't use anything I said or did to intensify their attack. The deputies drove me to the prison ward of the LA County Hospital to have my injuries checked. Within hours, I was declared fit and taken to the county jail. Familiar territory. This time, I was an adult and belonged here. This time, I faced a hard-time prison sentence for assaulting a police officer. On the bus to the county jail, a woman sat chained with her head down in a cage area near the driver. She looked up and saw me. "Hey, you, yeah, you, Ese, what's your name?" "No talking," shouted a deputy sitting nearby with a shotgun in his hand. In a few minutes, somebody passed me a gum wrapper. I grabbed it, although my arms and legs were also in chains. On it was a phone number and a woman's name, Licha. Licha Rubacalva and I appeared together for our preliminary hearing. She faced charges of drunk, disorderly conduct, and resisting arrest. I had disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, and assaulting an officer, presumably when my foot struck one of the deputies. Licha was 27 years old, a mother of three children, whose husband was serving time in Tracy Prison in Northern California. She lived in Riverside and worked as a barmaid. She was in Norwalk with friends that night just to party. We were assigned a public defender since neither one of us could afford our own counsel. The judge and the PD worked to determine whether we would be released on our own reconnaissance or forced to make bail. Both Licha and I were denied release. Licha ended up at the Sybil Brand Institute for Women. I went back to county jail. Before we split, we made a pact. Whoever gets out first has to go see the other one. "All right," Licha said. "That's fine with me." Despite some bruises, a swollen and cut lip, Licha looked real nice. Trying to get somebody to post bail became an arduous task. My parents didn't have any money. Neither did my brother. I called Chente and also tried the people at Cal State. And eventually I came up with enough for a bail bondsman, which was 10% of the required amount. As soon as I could, I went to Sybil Brand, which was over the freeway from Cal State and City Terrace. I was taken to a room where a scattered number of people visited with prisoners who were behind thick plates of glass. A guard brought Licha to where I was standing. She had on a blue smock, her hair in disarray, and bags beneath her eyes. She seemed embarrassed and didn't look at me at first. But she smiled prettily. "Man, I'm so happy to see you," she said. "Me too. How you been?" "What do you expect? These goddamn bitches treat you like shit here. All day they fuck with me." "Hey, don't get mad at me, Mujer. I'm sorry. You've been so sweet." She looked down embarrassed again. I looked at her wrist and saw a red tag. "Why do you have red on your wrist? What's that mean?" "Oh, it's nothing," Licha said. "Nah, why lie? It means I'm suicidal. I tried to cut my wrist here the other night." "No, Licha, don't do that. We'll help each other. You'll see. You'll be out in no time." "I'm so glad you're here, Louis. I really need you." We didn't know each other, but our experience brought us real close, real quick. We talked about so many things. I told her I'd help her make bail so we could work on our case together. I hustled money everywhere, even getting advances from work and using some of my college money. In the next weeks, I didn't attend any classes. I failed to follow up on the Loyola Marymount mural project and lost the account. But none of this mattered. What lay before me was a possible future in prison for something I didn't do. I had to do all I could to avoid this. I wasn't sure it would work. Licha was finally out on bail. We had a court hearing together, and I began to get help in trying to win the case. I approached a judge in San Gabriel who helped me out once when I was a juvenile offender. He remembered me, and, although it was a shot in the dark, wrote a letter to the court on my behalf. I then obtained letters from Mrs. Baez, from Chicano Studies professors at Cal State, and from EOP coordinators. I read all the letters. So many nice things were said about me. Sincere efforts to keep me out of La Pinta. I realized how much support I had, and I felt bad about failing all these people again, although I knew this time it wasn't entirely my fault. I called my public defender about the letters. He didn't know if they were going to do any good, but he would work with them. Unfortunately, Licha couldn't get anybody to write letters for her. We called each other almost daily. We made plans for me to visit her in Riverside. She gave me an address and I figured out the best way to get there. On a Saturday afternoon, I jumped on a bus from downtown Los Angeles to the desert. With all the stops, it was about a 2.5-hour ride. I pulled into the Riverside bus station in the early evening and stepped off, a small bag in my hand. There were a lot of people hanging around, some looking as if they had no other place to go. Drifters, the homeless and tired, men and women, unbathed and hungry. I continued past them, looking for Licha's street. I got lost a few times, asked directions, started out again, then lost more time because of wrong directions, but finally pulled myself back on track by the time it had gotten dark. I located Licha Street and kept going. It was a curbless road, small but well-kept homes to the sides of me. This was the Casablanca Barrio, one of the bigger Mexican enclaves in Southern California. I also knew it was tough territory, so I had to avoid bumping into any vatos. Licha's address finally popped up, but the house was dark. My heart seemed to drop in that instance. I took a deep breath, then walked up the weed-filled grass to the door and knocked. No answer. I found a doorbell, but it didn't work. So I knocked again. Still, no answer. I stood there for 45 minutes, not believing Licha wouldn't be there. She never showed. I kept on walking. By then it was late and awfully cold. It was too late to take a bus, so I couldn't get back home. But I knew something about surviving in the streets. I found a church with a set of double hardwood doors. I pushed in one door. It was open. Many churches stayed open all night for prayer. I walked up an aisle. Rows of pews radiated to the sides. An immense statue of Jesus Christ on the cross in front of me. Nobody else around. My footsteps rung out as I neared a pew at the front. I sat myself down on the hardness. The cold increased in intensity. I looked around at the statue, the lit candles, the stations of the cross. It had been a long time since I'd been inside a church. Although, at my mother's heeding, I had gone through all the required sacraments. Some years back, I stopped religious instruction, making confession or attending Mass. A priest once called me a bonehead heathen, and I never returned. I lay back on the wood, closed my eyes, and descended into sleep. More bad news. Quinta Sol Publications was embroiled in an internal squabble. One of its editors split from it and started his own press. This editor took along with him a number of Quinta Sol's authors, splitting up the contracted books. My book, unfortunately, was too far off in production and had to be put on hold. Eventually, it got dropped in the jostling, and Quinta Sol reorganized into Tonatia Press without me. I also got word the deputies who filed the assault charges on me were going to attend the hearing. The public defender said this looked bad. If I pled not guilty, I would have a trial. But if a jury were to convict, I would obtain a prison term. The public defender made an offer. I think you should copy plea. No, man, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't assault no cops. They assaulted me, and I've got the scars to prove it. It's their word against yours. You got nothing to stand on. Nobody's going to testify for you. They're all scared. This happens all the time. Your only hope is to plea bargain. I just can't. It's the principal. Fuck, principal, it's your ass here. You got some good letters. They're good enough for the judge to consider another plea. But you have to cooperate. You have to say guilty to something else, okay? Come on, Luis. This is the only chance you got. Louis, do it, Licha interjected. Take the lesser charge. Although Licha had stood me up, she said she forgot I was coming. She didn't give any excuses and apologized. I felt she didn't owe me anything, so I let the incident drop. I don't know, I said. It's not right. They'll do it to somebody else. I turned away. I also felt scared. I knew the chances of a judge giving me a break if I pled not guilty were practically nil. But I recalled the beating, the way the fists came at me, the taunting, the thrust of blackjacks. I just couldn't let these deputies get away with it. I called Chente to hear what he had to say. Chente understood the dilemma, but he also felt I needed to get out of this as fast and as cleanly as possible. You're fighting something more powerful than your puny plea for justice, Chente said. Your day will come. Our day will come. But right now, you can't make up for the Chicano moratorium, for Miguel Robles and all the others who've suffered because of this society. It's more important you are around to do the hard work required to help change this. Licha and I showed up together for the next hearing. She looked sharp in a tight-fitting gray and black dress suit. She had her hair streaked, her face healed, so much beauty shone through again. You look pretty today. Oh, querido, you look pretty too. Then the public defender arrived. The judge is prepared to offer a plea, Luis. The judge has the letters, but you got to tell me now. This is it. There's no backing off. What do you say? Are the arresting deputies in there? Yes, they're there and looking for a kill. Don't mess with this. Take the plea. Okay, I'll do it. Licha swung her arms around my neck. She smiled and kissed me on the cheek. The PD went away to work out the deal. Inside, my nerves jumped up and down. At the same time, I felt somewhat relieved. I wanted out of this mess. I had no choice, but I would never forget what the deputies did to me. The humiliation, the pain, the indignities I would never forget. We were called into the courtroom, on the side with the officers in uniform. The public defender addressed the court, saying I would accept guilt for the lesser charge of drunk and disorderly. I looked over at the deputies, who exhibited a tinge of disappointment. The judge didn't take much time. He had the letters on his desk. He remarked to me about the break he was giving me in consideration of my support and newfound objectives. Although Leecha didn't have the same support, he gave us both a break. My sentence involved a fine and few months of incarceration in county jail. The PD shook my hand. Leecha hugged me real tight as tears streamed down her face. She had to do her time in Sybil Brand. As soon as we're out, let's get together, all right? Leecha, I'm sorry it worked out this way, but with everything bad, something good usually comes along with it. The day I left county jail, Leecha came for me. Again, she looked radiant, although she was almost 10 years older than me and a single mother of three. Come with me to Riverside and stay a few days. It's not going to be like the last time, is it? No, Louis. I told you that wasn't my fault. Man, you don't forget nothing, do you? Okay, let's start over. That's what I want to do. Just start over. By then, I was so far out of it that I forgot about Camila, my art, and the book. I was back to the way of the hood. We drove the long stretch of Interstate 60 to Riverside. When we arrived in town, she took me to the bar where she worked to pick up an old check they held for her. I entered the bar, although I was 18 years old and this was a 21 and over joint. But nobody questioned me. Besides, for years, I looked older than my actual age. Leecha directed me to the back room. I lingered next to a time clock as she rummaged through a drawer to get her check. Stay here. I'm going to get her cashed. When she returned, Leecha stood by the time clock and filled out a time card. I got my job back. Man, I'm so happy. As she turned toward me, I pulled her near me, and our lips touched. A light contact, but driven by sensuous quest. We kissed again, this time long, deep, and smothering, something we both desired for a long time, neither of us wanting to stop. Louis, Leecha finally took a breath. Let's go home. I left Riverside with images of the weekend etched in my mind. Milk dripped from Leecha's breast as the nipples puckered with excitement. Tremors rumbled throughout our bodies, me crumbling beneath her fingers. Before I left, Leecha went into the house and gave me a record, Daddy's Home, by Shep and the Limelighters. But a month later, as I tried to negotiate a time to see her again, she said I was too young for her. The relationship would never work. I tried to argue against this. One day in the mail, Leecha sent me another record, You're Still a Young Man by Tower of Power. There were no more arguments for me. Chapter 10. I glimpsed in the distance certain roads, clearing silent in the morning, after the night's demons have fled. The future, the ageless future, where there is always time to create. Maurice Sachs. Alone at a bus stop in the first hours every day, I wrapped myself in a long black trench coat, no longer used for hambas or jales. Que jodida, it's cold, I stammered out loud to no one in particular. Trucks rumbled by, and an occasional lowrider, sweet salsa sounds radiating from outside speakers. I jumped to the beat inside the trench coat as a breeze played havoc with my insides. I reflected on writing and art, on class struggle, on family and a woman's touch. What mattered to me then? I stopped attending Cal State after my release from jail. I'd been sent back too far. Besides, I ran out of money. I now worked full-time on the graveyard shift of a paper factory. I also realized sitting in a classroom didn't work for me. It revived images of what I endured as a child, and something within me blocked against it. I preferred my own inquiries, reading everything I could when I needed to. The incidents of violence continued. A week before, a dude from Sangra strutted down Mission Boulevard when a carload approached and someone opened fire. The dude dropped to the ground and rolled over beside a mailbox. But the car turned around and somebody stepped out with a shotgun and blasted him again. It was at such close range, the wadding from the shell embedded in his stomach. I now looked on these matters with different eyes. I recalled when this first happened. Chente and I had been at his house, talking about the hills and how I had to defend it, whatever the cost. That's exactly what the rulers of this country want you to do, Chente said, instead of directing your fury at the real source of the problem. But this is my hood. There's so much to be done here. There's much to be done everywhere. You need to broaden your experiences, find out what the rest of the world is all about. I understand, but I can't leave now. Lomas is everything. It's my family. It's my world. Chente then placed a small globe in my hand and twirled it once. Okay, Luis, tell me. Where is Las Lomas on this globe? I gazed at the revolving sphere, the colors, the place names, the lines of mountain ridges and contours of islands and nations. I stopped the globe from its spin and found the United States. I turned it slightly to California, then cast down to a dot which claimed Los Angeles. But there was no Lomas, no South San Gabriel. You see, Lomas is so tiny, nameless, it doesn't even warrant a dot, Chente explained. Tavantos defend a land which doesn't even belong to them. All the death. For what? I thought about the globe. Chente was right. A bigger world awaited me. But I also knew, once you're in Las Lomas, you never get out, unless you're dead. Chente, I thank you for all you've done, but I can't leave, I said. I have to try and reason with the homeboys to stop the killings in my own way. I spent a few nights pacing up and down the hills, talking to the vatos. They listened and appeared as if maybe, just maybe, I made sense. When this happened, I wanted to stick it out. They would understand, I thought, if they were willing to learn, if they had the proper leadership. One night, in the fields, I stood among a line of dudes against the wall. Somebody passed around a super cool, a cigarette laced with angel dust. Everyone before me inhaled it, but when it came to me, I refused. Come on, it said, just a toke, said the guy in front of me. Chale, I don't go that way no more. Fuck it, you take it then, the guy said to someone next to me. But to our surprise, he also refused. Then the next guy, and the next. Nobody wanted the super cool after me. As soon as somebody took a stand and turned it down, the others did the same. I arrived at a point which alarmed even me, where I had no desire for the internal night, the buoyancy of letting go, the bliss of the void. I required more, a discipline as bulwark within which to hold all I valued, a shield against the onslaught. I figured I could help the homeboys become warriors of a war worth fighting, convinced they would let go of the intoxications, even heroin, if they had something more meaningful in their lives. If only. Just then, a 1955 Bel Air came toward me. I recognized the car. It belonged to Enano. I looked closer at the occupants inside, Peaches, Topo, Enano, and Fuzzy. Three of them had blue bandanas above fierce dark faces. I smiled, gave them the Lomas hand sign. The bomb stopped in front of me. Topo, the first one to initiate me into the hood, sat on the passenger side with a small brim hat on his head. He looked straight at me, returned the smile, then picked up his hand to reveal a handgun. My face flushed. For seconds, time stood still. For seconds, my mind raced, trying to figure out what was going on. Dots promenaded back and forth, telling me to drop down to protect myself, at the same time denying everything in front of me. Topo pulled the trigger, and a familiar blast burst forth, sharp and furious. I fell in that instance, popping noises blasting about my ears. I heard the car screech away, while I crawled as fast as I could behind a brick wall. They would come back, I thought. If they knew I was alive, they would come back. I leaned heavily against the wall, breathing hard and sweating la gota gorda. Through a window, I could see an illuminated painting of La Virgen de Guadalupe. Around me were an array of trash cans. An alley cat emerged from the garbage, scared as I was scared. For a long time, nothing transpired. Nobody came. The bomb did not return. There was just me, a mangy cat, a bench full of bullet holes, and Mother Mary, perpetually smiling. I slowly rose to my feet. None of the bullets had struck me. My eyes burned with fury, with sorrow. I wanted to yell. I wanted to cry. I didn't know what I wanted. And thinking back, I realized if they wanted to kill me, they would have. These were warning shots, as if to say, next time, you're dead. The homeboys tried to kill me. Vatos, whom I had known as brothers, with whom I scurried down muddy streets and slept next to in jail, with whom I partied and hung out in front of courthouses and the fields. They were dudes I fought for and with whom I shared a taste of La Carga. I would have died for them. There comes a moment when one faces the fresh features of an inner face, a time of conscious rebirth, when the accounting's done, the weave in its final flourish, a time when a man stands before the world, vulnerable, nothing owed, and considers his place in it. I had reached such a moment. I'm ready to leave, Chente. There's nothing for me here anymore. Chente arranged for me to hide out in a federally subsidized housing project in San Pedro. I spent 2 months there trying to clarify the issues before me. During spare moments, I played street football with others from across the country who were also there, some from kindred conditions. Before I left for San Pedro, I closed the doors of my garage room for the last time. My books and papers packed in boxes, my few belongings stashed away until I could reclaim them. I said goodbye to my mother and father, who looked old and drawn out. I never liked the walkouts, the revolutionary talk, and the books you read, Mama said. but you stuck by what you believe in. And I respect you for that. This meant much to me, hearing it from my mother. I gave her a sustained and sad-filled embrace. My father didn't say a great deal. He gave me a brief, awkward hug and then shook my hand. If you need anything, money, place to stay, you have it here. That's good to hear, Dad. Thanks. Although my father had been jailed and falsely accused like me before he left Mexico for the United States, we never related our experiences. He was a man of few words, and I stopped expecting more. As I drove away from the house, I swung by the hills, everything eerily quiet. It felt strange to leave such a place and such a time in so much silence. I visited the Resurrection Cemetery, passing through the large ornate gates and parked. I strolled across the sheen of wet grass and up easy slopes, sprinkled here and there with marble headstones, flowers everywhere. A small boy in a wrinkled suit raced past. Nearby, a family stood around a recently covered burial spot. There wasn't much to see that day, compared to the times when cars stretched for miles, winding around the curves of cemetery roads as they led to a casket next to chairs, wreaths, and a mound of red dirt. I recall the old people who came here, the men in brown suede hats and canes, and black-shawled women with rosaries clutched inside vein-streaked hands. I recall the mothers who had to be restrained as they lay across the casket, beseeching to be buried with their son or daughter. I recall the working men with their calloused palms and sun-beaten faces whose hardened eyes were forged from the heat of foundries or from under the sun's gaze. And I remembered the stream which emanated from those dense eyes, how it pulled something raw and smoldering from every one of us. I recalled the young people, dudes in long sleeve shirts and pressed pants, and girls with harsh makeup and sometimes infants against their shoulders. The deafening yells, the wet stained cheeks, the touch of a trembling hand. I remembered it all. I left before the teardrops fell, for fear they'd never stop. In South San Gabriel, as elsewhere, events crashed into each other. A jury found Fred Coates, the deputy responsible for Miguel Robles' death, innocent of all charges, as they had done for virtually every deputy ever accused of maiming or killing an unarmed person of color. The sheriff's office assigned Coates to another part of the county. Soon, we heard reports he faced an investigation for beating up a black youth. Even Puppet failed to escape the transitions. A couple of Mexican immigrants shot him when he chased them following a minor argument. He lived, but I later learned he accepted Jesus Christ as his personal savior. The scourge of PCP, angel dust, had begun to grip almost every facet of Barrio life. Whole neighborhoods became like ghost towns, as increasing numbers of young people were hooked into this overpowering narcotic, easily manufactured in backroom laboratories and distributed widely and cheaply. Although PCP preceded the crack epidemic, it was enough to make blabbering idiots of once vigorous boys and girls. La Casa Community Center became a major casualty of PCP. I once visited Sal Basuto, who showed me around so I could see the devastation. pieces of pool table on the floor of the youth center, torn mattresses where runaways hid to snort, chewed up, or smoke angel dust. Anything of value gone. As if everything around Sal, all he had fought for, caved under PCP. In a matter of a year or two, the murals I painted through the Bienvenidos Community Center were whitewashed. The backlash against them proved swift and extensive. Only one mural survived, the one I finished on Chicano history for the inside of the Del Mar Children's Library. Once in a while, I'd wander in there and sit down to gaze at the panels without saying a word. One of the few remaining shrines of that tumultuous period. Mark Keppel High School continued in crisis, including undergoing a major confrontation the following year after I graduated. The police attacked a group of students on the lawn, at one point smearing the face of a pregnant girl into the ground and yanking students from the hallways. About 20 young people were taken to the police station and booked. A meeting was immediately called in which the police responded to inquiries about the incident. I returned to attend and saw fathers and mothers, people who paid taxes, who obeyed laws, who came to this country to work and better their lives, approach the police representatives as if they were going to pluck out their eyeballs. The police got flustered and had to promise to return all the mugshots to the parents and remove any statements of wrongdoing from the students' records. I also learned the Movimiento bookstore shut down when the body of Al Pachi Alvarez was found in Garvey Park with a bullet hole through his head. His murder was never solved. But the most critical blow came with the closing of the Bienvenidos Community Center. According to some insiders, a prison gang had taken over various community centers across the county. There also appeared to be a move to take over Bienvenidos. Mrs. Baez, who chaired the board, figured the only way to keep the center out of their hands was for the board to disband, a sort of scorched earth policy. Although the food co-op continued on its own for a while, even opening up a separate storefront, the center's programs, the John Favela Youth Center, the dropout school and daycare, all closed their doors, leaving Las Lomas with what it had once before, nothing. Along with all this, the neighborhoods also changed. What I had unknowingly conjured up in my theatrical productions came to fruition as land developers, along with county and city officials, tore up whole streets to build new townhouses, malls, and expensive condos. One year, I visited my mother and father, who still lived in the house in San Gabriel. By then, the house had been stuccoed over, another bedroom added, and a second house filled the backyard. My old garage room had been repainted and now served as storage. My mother explained how many more Asians had moved into the newly constructed areas. One day, a new mall opened where the drive-in used to be. Mama and my sister Anna walked over there to check it out. But as soon as they got there, they slow walked through the crowd, feeling out of place. There were hundreds of Chinese newly arrived in this country, talking only in their language. None of the items in the stores were marked in English or Spanish. Mama didn't mind the Chinese people. In some ways, their culture recalled her Mexican Indian upbringing. But it was evident the mall had no place for the Mexicans remaining in the area. There were no efforts to reach out, no means of inclusion, something our family had long experienced. This wasn't about being Asian. Money talked here. Big money. Similarly, a good part of the hills found itself swept away with the massive land deals and influx of investments during the 1970s and 1980s. Between the police, Pacific Rim money, and developers, the hills didn't have much of a chance. After San Pedro, I traveled to Chicago with Chente and a few others to attend a meeting with people from throughout the United States, Canada, Mexico, and Puerto Rico. The morning we arrived in the city, the skyline rose from the horizon, glittering in the sunlight like an emerald city, so magical and massive. Yet, as we drove through it, Chicago struck me as dark and dirty. The brick buildings covered with black soot as the smoke and silt from steel mills, bucket shops, and other industry slaughtered the sky and dusted the streets, alleys, and gangways. Here was a city unlike any I had ever seen. Another world, and it beckoned like books, like the passes to knowledge and the ripening spring of a new world. The city pulled me in, and although it would be another 12 years before I ended up there, it never let me go. When I returned to Los Angeles, I moved to Boyle Heights and later to neighborhoods such as White Fence, Florence, South Pasa, La Colonia Watts, and Garrity Loma. I found work in foundries, refineries, steel mills, and construction sites, which I would do for another 7 years before pursuing the disciplines of journalism and literature. I soon worked with community leaders who battled against police terror, labor issues, the rights of the undocumented, for tenant rights and decent education. They were welfare mothers, war veterans, trade union members, students, and unemployed, a mixture of nationalities and colors, linked by an economic equality, a commonality of survival. One day, at the Aliso Village Pico Gardens housing projects, where I organized among some of the most neglected youth in the city, I asked Camila Martinez to marry me. In the summer of 1974, soon after I turned 20, Camila and I wed at the Guadalupe Church on Hazard Avenue, a traditional East LA wedding, complete with a lowrider caravan, fights and chair throwing at the reception, and the bride and groom sneaking out in a beat-up bug for a honeymoon at a sleazy, crumbling motel where we ended up after running out of gas. I began a new season of life, intellect and body fused. I now yearned to contribute fully, embodied with conscious energy, to live a deliberate existence dedicated to a future humanity which might, in complete freedom, achieve the realization of its creative impulses, the totality of its potential faculties, without injustice, coercion, hunger, and exploitation. I made a quinceañera dance at the American Legion Hall in San Gabriel. My cousins, one of Theo Kiko's daughters. I'm older, married with a child, and dressed in plain shirt and pants. Hair shortened, not much to show for what I'd been through only a short time earlier. I step outside to take in some air. I lean against a parked sedan, looking at the stars, which seem extraordinarily large and bright this evening. Just then, a short figure, wobbling, with a kind of limp, moves toward me. He has a blue beanie cap over his head and a dark hooded sweatshirt. "You Chin de Lomas," says the figure. I don't recognize him, not even the voice, which rasps as much as it slurs. No pangs of familiarity. I guess I am, but it's been a long time since anyone's called me that. "You're going to die." What are you talking about? You thought you killed me, but you didn't, the dude says, haltingly, measuring every word. I took all your shanks, 8 of them, right here. The dude lifts up the sweatshirt. A ghastly number of scars traverse his torso. A plastic bag is strapped at his side to hold his urine. You did this to me. Look hard. You did this. You got it wrong, Chava. It wasn't me. Sure, I heard it all before. I know who did this, and you're going to pay. From the sides emerge 2 other guys, healthy and strong, looking like street, although a lot younger than the both of us. Chava, listen, I say. I heard about what happened that night, but I wasn't there. For some time now, I've been working my way out of that useless existence. Now, I've found something to live for, bigger than you and me, bigger than Lomas and Sangra. You don't want me. Chava gets closer, alcohol on his breath. I can see tears forming in his eyes.
Lomas did this. Somebody has to pay, he yells, while pulling off the beanie cap, revealing a misshapen head with scattered slivers of hair.
The scars on his body don't compare to those on his head and the side of his face. They're larger, with indentations and purplish membranes.
Look what you did to me. Somebody has to pay for this, Chava repeats.
He's so disturbed, I can see him pulling out a knife and stabbing me just to salve his pain. I look at the guys next to me, and they strike me as too young and inexperienced to act. I keep talking. There are some things to fight for, some things to die for, but not this, Chava. You're alive. I feel for you, man, but you're alive. Don't waste the rest of your days with this hate. What's revenge? What can you get by getting to me? I'm the least of your enemies. It's time to let it go. It's time to go on with your life. Chava begins to shudder, to utter something, a guttural sound rising to his throat, a hideous moan. I think he's trying to cry, but it's hard to tell. I don't know what to do, so I pull him close to me. He twists away. The dudes to the side look lost, not knowing their next move, unprepared for what follows. I again pull at Chava and hold him. He breaks down, a flood of fermented rage seeping out of every pore. If I thought my life could cleanse you of the hurt, of the memory, I would open up my shirt and let you take it from me. But it won't. We're too much the same now, Chava. Let it all out, man. Let it out. I hold Chava as if he were cornmeal in my arms. Then pity overwhelms me. This complicated affection, which cuts across the clear-cut states of being we'd rather seek. Here's friend, here's enemy, here's sadness, here's happiness, here's right, here's wrong. Pity draws from all these opposing elements and courses through me like an uncooked stew, mixing and confusing the paradoxes, because now this man I once admired, if not revered, I once feared, if not hated, stands here, a fragment of the race, drunk, agonized, crushed, and I can't hate him anymore. I can't see him as the manifestation of craziness and power he once possessed. He's a caricature, an aberration, but also more like me, capable of so much ache beneath the exterior of so much strength. Pity links us in a perverted way, transcending our veneers, joining us in our vulnerability, and at the same time distancing us from one another. I want to escape from Chava's tired, perplexed, and tattered face, to run away from how something so beautiful
in its own way can become so odious. After an eternal minute, Chava pushes me away, wipes his face with a soiled sleeve, and then turns. The dudes next to us don't seem to know what to do but follow. I see Chava hobble away, two confused teenagers at his side, and as he vanishes into a flicker of neon, I hear the final tempo of the crazy life leave my body, the last song before the dying, lapsing forever out of mine as Chava disappears, enveloped in flames breaking through the asphalt, rested into the black heart of night. Epilogue. Go ahead and kill us. We're already dead. Young Latino participant in the 1992 Los Angeles uprising, as quoted in USA Today, May 1, 1992. This book is a gift to my son, Ramiro, to all my children, who will traverse a more severe and uncertain path to maturity than I had to undertake. I look at him now, at his handsome face, at his almond-shaped eyes and cinnamon color, and it's hard to believe how many impacted layers of hurt and abuse these features conceal. He has a right to be angry, and he's not the only one. From Chicago, we watched the fires that consumed miles of Los Angeles and some other American cities beginning on April 29, the day a jury in Simi Valley, California, declared four police officers innocent of excessive force in the beating of Rodney King. Fire, for me, has been a constant motif. I was 11 years old when the 1965 Watts Rebellion tore through my former neighborhood. At age 16, I participated in the Chicano moratorium against the Vietnam War, the so-called East LA riot. Later, mostly as a journalist, I witnessed uprisings in such far-flung places as Uchitán, Oaxaca, Overton in Miami, and the Bulls Revolution after the Chicago Bulls won their second NBA championship on June 14, 1992. The heart of the LA uprising was in the African-American community, but it soon involved large numbers of Latinos, who make up almost half of South Central's population, and whites. Latinos were the largest group among the 18,000 arrested. At least 700 of those detained were white. Some called it the country's first multi-ethnic revolt. The common link was the class composition of the combatants. Los Angeles, 1992, was the first social response to an economic revolution which began years before. The shift from mechanical productive energy to one based on electronics. In Los Angeles, this translated into tens of thousands of jobs lost as factories such as Goodyear, Firestone, General Motors, Bethlehem Steel, and American Bridge closed down forever, many of which I worked for during the 1970s. Along with this came the cyclical crisis of glutted markets and a shrinking consumer base, where more was being produced by fewer people, as the new technology could only integrate a few. The mode of distribution began to break down, from cars to electronic items, including such necessities as food, clothing, and homes. Goods lay idle while an increasing number of people had to do without. The resultant economic decay. LA has the second largest homeless population in the country, was the foundation for the kind of response that followed the Rodney King verdicts. Add to this one of the most brutal police forces in America, and you have a riot in the making. It was only a matter of time. Government officials at local, state, and federal levels proved they would not allow any serious challenge to the economic and political underpinnings of poverty in this country. They dispatched National Guard and Army troops who turned their guns against Americans barely more than a year after the bloody, for the Iraqi people, Persian Gulf War. The alley violence also uncovered a two-year effort to unite the two largest gangs in the city, the Bloods and Crips. A Bloods Crips proposal for LA's facelift was soon circulated. It proposed building parks and community centers, repaving streets and schools, not just reconstructing the taco stands, liquor stores, and exploitative businesses which dotted the South Central landscape before the uprising. A radio broadcast stated that in a 3-mile radius of South Central, there were some 640 liquor stores, although not one movie house or community center. A major decline of gang-related incidents was reported throughout the South Central community. Graffiti sprouted up with sentiments such as Mexicans and Crips and Bloods together, although police later removed most of the unity-related scrawl. In the months after the uprising, police broke up as many gang unity rallies as they could, arresting truce leaders and inflaming the ire of residents of housing projects in which many of the rallies were being held. The LAPD told the media they feared the gangs were going to turn on them, possibly ambush them. Yet, no police officer has been killed or severely hurt since the Keene verdicts, even during the uprising, although instances have emerged of police shooting several people, some in the back, during and since the riots. Then, several hundred FBI agents were sent in to break up the gangs involved in the April-May violence, the largest investigation of its kind. Although there were some 600 Los Angeles youth killed in 1991 from gang and drug-related incidents, the federal government never before provided the commitment or resources that they have since the Crips and Bloods declared peace. At the same time, the immigration authorities terrorized Mexican and Central American immigrants, placing the Pico Union community under a virtual state of siege. This area was one of the hardest hit in the fires. They deported thousands of heavily tattooed gang members to Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Belize, exporting the gang cholo culture to countries that had never experienced this level of gang violence. This is not the first time the federal government has intervened. It has derailed and, whenever possible, destroyed the unity which emerged out of the Watts Rebellion, out of the Chicano Moratorium, out of the Wounded Knee protests. In the 1960s and 1970s, the Black Panthers, the Brown Berets, the American Indian Movement, the Young Lords, the Weathermen, Puerto Rican Liberation Groups, the Chicano Liberation Front, and more recently MOVE, the Republic of New Africa, FALN, the Black Liberation Army, every major organized expression for justice and liberation was targeted, its leaders killed or jailed, its forces scattered. To challenge how power is held in America meant facing a reign of terror, some of which I witnessed over the years, most of which failed to reach mainstream America. Although this is changing, LA helped bring it home. This is the legacy of the period covered in this book. This is what my son, Ramiro, and his generation have inherited. what to do with those whom society cannot accommodate. Criminalize them, outlaw their actions and creations, declare them the enemy, then wage war. Emphasize the differences, the shade of skin, the accent in the speech or manner of clothes. Like the scapegoat of the Bible, place society's ills on them, then stone them in absolution. It's convenient. It's logical. It doesn't work. Gangs are not alien powers. They begin as unstructured groupings, our children who desire the same as any young person, respect, a sense of belonging, protection, the same thing that the YMCA, Little League, or the Boy Scouts want. It wasn't any more than what I wanted as a child. Gangs flourish when there's a lack of social recreation, decent education, or employment. Today, many young people will never know what it is to work. They can only satisfy their needs through collective strength against the police, who hold the power of life and death, against poverty, against idleness, against their impotence in society. Without definitive solutions, it's easy to throw blame. For instance, politicians have recently targeted the so-called lack of family values. But family is a force among the propertyless and disenfranchised. Too many families are wrenched apart as even children are forced to supplement meager incomes. Family can only really exist among those who can afford one. In an increasing number of homeless, poor, and working poor families, the things that people must do to survive undermines most family structures. At a home for troubled youth on Chicago's South Side, for example, I met a 13-year-old boy who was removed from his parents after police found him selling chewing gum at bars and restaurants without a peddler's license. I recall at the age of 9, my mother walking me to the door and in effect saying, "Now go forth and work." People can't just consume in this society. They have to sell something, including their ability to work. If decent work is unavailable, people will do the next best thing, such as sell sex or dope. I've talked to enough gang members and low-level dope dealers to know they would quit today if they had a productive, livable wage job. You'll find people who don't care about who they hurt, but nobody I know wants to sell death to their children, their neighbors, and friends. If there was a viable alternative, they would stop. If we all had a choice, I'm convinced nobody would choose La Vida Loca, the insane nation, to gangbang. But it's going to take collective action and a plan. 20 years ago, at 18 years old, I felt like a war veteran with a sort of post-traumatic stress syndrome. I wanted the pain to end, the self-consuming hate to wither in the sunlight. With the help of those who saw potential in me, I got out. And what of my son? Recently, Ramiro went up to the stage at a Chicago poetry event and read a moving piece about being physically abused by stepfather when he was a child. It stopped everyone cold. He later read the poem to some 2,000 people at Chicago's Poetry Festival. Its title, Running Away. There's a small but intense fire burning in Ramiro. He turned 17 in 1992. He's made it so far, but every day is a challenge. Now I tell him, you have worth outside of a job, outside the jacket imposed on you since birth. Draw on your expressive powers.
Stop running. July 1992.
This recording of Always Running by Luis Rodriguez was presented by Dreamscape Media, LLC. We hope you've enjoyed this audiobook. Thank you for listening. Please check www.dreamscapeab.com for Dreamscape's latest releases.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.